So good evening, everyone. Happy New Year to you. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. And thank you, Nick, for coming to see us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me.
It's always a pleasure. We go back to Nick's very first book when I got a phone call from his publicist saying, well, I mean, I don't want to put this badly, but I will say it's doing better than we thought. So we'd like to send him somewhere. So are you willing to take him, you know, on very short term notice? I said, well, of course, because we live for debuts. You know, nothing is more fun for us. Well, that's not true. It's wonderful for us to get to meet new authors. And the truth is, if you don't get to meet them when they start, you never get that whole trajectory. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have managed to do that now. For how many books is this? Number 7?
Book 7.
Lucky number 7. Yeah. And it's really lucky number 7 because Nick got a rave review in the New York Times on Sunday, which I thought was, you know, you can compare Peter Ash to Jack Reacher, but it's nice when somebody in the New York Times compares Peter Ash to Jack Reacher. But at the same time, I did think the way Sarah ended that up was really good when she said, you know that Peter's not going to take a bullet, you know, in the forehead, and he will live to return. But at the same time, Nick has created a real sense of danger and, you know, and stakes that feel real. It's not just, you know, like some comic book version.
Well, that's kind of for me, that's the whole idea, is for those characters to feel real. A thriller isn't very thrilling if you don't care about the characters and if they don't feel like they're at risk. So that's, to me, that's the whole idea, is to have them be, to feel mortal in the way that I guess not every character does.
So when we met Peter, how many of you have read all of them? Any of you read them all? Oh, good. Okay. So you recall when he was kind of living under the porch and, you know, didn't have regular employment and all the rest of it. He's come a long way now because, you know, now he's got June and he's got Lewis and, you know, all this other stuff. But anyway, I really like the first book, but I still say that the opening scenes of the second book, Burning Bright, were maybe the most exciting thriller chase. Remember Across the Trees? I've never read anything quite so good as far as that, you know, I mean, and it went on for a long time too. It was many pages. It wasn't like just he hopped from a tree, but I mean, he raced across those trees for pages.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun to do. I'm a tree climber from way, way back, although I've never climbed a redwood, but that was a huge chunk of my childhood, was climbing trees.
Where?
Yeah. Wisconsin.
Okay. But yeah. They have real trees.
They do. They have real. Oh, yeah. Not. They, you don't really have those sorts of trees here, but yeah.
I grew up not far from you.
I know.
Remember?
I know.
So I used to hang out at the apple tree in our backyard. I remember I used to practice like hanging by my heels, hanging by my knees. We had in Chicago, we had serious trees too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So I understand about trees. I still think every time I walk out into my backyard and look up at the palm trees and all, that I'm on vacation. If you grew up in Chicago, you always feel like you're on vacation if you're somewhere like Arizona.
That's a fine way to live.
Yeah.
That's a fine way to live. Yeah.
There's some drive for you to come to see me in January.
Oh, well. I would say the order of priority for me is Barbara 1, Bookstore 2, Readers 3, Dinner afterwards.
Dinner, right. It's the
four.
Whole package,
yes,
here.
Yeah.
Many of you may have heard me say this, but it's true that one of the biggest reasons the authors come to the Poison Pen is dinner. It's the after party. My husband will be cooking for Ace on Saturday because Ace wants to meet the puppies. It's too late. Ace is at 4. If we were doing this at an earlier hour, we'll do that another time. Right. But anyway, we do. And one reason that we really have such great relationships with authors is that, you know, we take time to get to know them and they take time to get to know us. And right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I authors often do something that's called a radio tour, where there's a whole day full of 5 to 10 minute, you know, drive time shock jock radio interviews and podcasts and all that kind of stuff, and that there's such a difference between the 5 minute, you know, zoo in the morning well, Nick Petrie's here, and we're talking about his new book. And they've clearly never read it, and may have never read a book in their lives. And I'm certainly grateful for the exposure. And I try to talk coherently about my book in 5 minutes. But it's such a different experience to come here and talk to real readers. And Barbara, who has been so influential in the world of books.
And who actually reads your books.
Yes.
Cover to cover.
Yes, which I appreciate.
Yeah. I told you, or maybe I haven't, maybe some of you heard me say that Dave Barry, who, you know, is a terrific writer, wrote a thriller about a guy. I don't know if any of you ever read it. It was about a guy in Florida. He lived in a tree and his job was voting. He took money for voting. Was that
Big Trouble?
Yep, that was it. And this was long before Trump. But anyway, the little guy, he lived in a tree, and that's how he made his living, was voting. But anyway, so we had a little TV show over at the Scottsdale Library, and that, which led, in fact, to our whole, you know, video thing we've been doing for over 20 years. So it was the most popular show on the city TV channel. But they shut it down because somebody in the council thought that it wasn't fair that a business got free exposure. Now, I never mentioned the poison pen. It was totally free programming by some really famous people, but I'm sure this councilman didn't read. Anyway, so Dave Barry is scheduled to interview with me. And on that day when he's flying in to do that in the afternoon before we do our event here at the store, he's on the Today Show. So when Dave got here, I said to him, I got up this morning at 5, I said, and terrified myself by watching you on the Today Show. And he looked at me with this big smile and he said, you know, that was all about them. He said, but this is going to be all about me, right? Which was really kind because, you know, he put me at ease. But nonetheless, he was not kidding that, you know, as you point out, those guys don't have time to read books. And
no,
you know,
it's a whole different thing.
Yeah, it is. Well, let's go back to the book. So number two is when, if I remember right, Peter meets June.
Yes.
All right, yeah. So why did you decide to progress him from a guy living under the porch with the occasional dog or whatever? why did you decide that you were gonna start adding characters? Is that a necessary part of writing a series?
I don't know. That's actually a really interesting question. The June appeared in the second book. I give myself an assignment for every book, and the assignment for that book was Peter Falls in Love. And because Peter is an itinerant character, he couldn't have the same person. Like he had an affair sort of kind of off screen in the first book, at the very end. But because Peter moved on, there had to be a new person, and I had to figure out the kind of person that would work with him and with his. You know, he's a challenging person for sure. And so he needed a really strong partner. Mm-hmm. I thought the next book June wouldn't be in. I thought I'd be done
One
with
and
June
done.
For a while. Well, because at the end of the second book, a little bit of a spoiler, she says basically, come back when you get your shit together. Because he didn't really have his shit together.
Nor was he really ever going to.
No, he may never get his shit together. He's making progress though. A guy can hope, but so I sort of thought, well, then June is not going to be in the next book. But I tried and tried to write a book that didn't have her in it, and it just did not cohere.
I mean, once you met her, you couldn't ditch her.
Yes, and so there are really only three recurring characters anyway. There's Lewis, right, who we meet in the first book, and there's June, who we meet in the second book. And I my goal is to have with every book to have a character who you would want to see again, to have a character that the reader likes enough, and or is compelling enough, maybe in a bad way, to come back. And that's sort of my goal with those secondary characters. But I don't think I've written enough books to get to sort of do some of that yet. But like Eli from the Memphis book, I would love to see what Eli's life is like, you know, 5 years later, 10 years later. You know, there's a one of the bad guys who's sort of a government, an undercover government assassin on the spectrum from the second book,
right.
Shepard, who I always thought would be fun to come back and sort of join the team again for a book. So I have all of these characters I want to see again, but there's so much more flexibility if you only have a couple of recurring characters to keep track of, to show the development of. And I'm always I'm always worried that I'm going to be repeating myself. So being able to go someplace new and introduce a lot of new characters is a way that helps me feel better about it, at least.
Well, that's where the Jack Reacher parallel comes in part, is that, you know, every book you read, Peter's in some place new. So you avoid a lot of baggage that way, but of course you get a lot of challenges. So let's see, in book three, we are, is it Wyoming, where they're running the, I don't want to talk about the plot too much. Where are we? Colorado?
Colorado.
Well, close. Okay, so Middle America, that's another thing that you write about more often mm-hmm. than many authors. You know, you're, instead of being coastal, you're in Middle America. So it's Colorado. And, you know, since you wrote that book, we've legalized cannabis here. And but I'm not sure that you can yet bank the money. What's happened with that now that it's legal?
Well, there was, when Obama was president, there was some talk about sort of basically decriminalizing the process for banks. So in case you're not following this, the states have made it legal. Some states have made it legal.
Colorado being one.
It was the first one to really go all in, which is why that book is set in Colorado.
Right.
To sell cannabis on a state level, but federal banks, any financial institution with a federal charter could not accept that money under federal law. And
right.
so basically, people were doing all of these transactions in cash. You couldn't use a credit card because, again, national organization, right? So that was part of the premise of the book, is there are all of these companies that sprung up. Many of them run by veterans to basically protect the pop guys and to shepherd their money from place to place. But so there was a there's a company in Washington State that, and I'm not sure if it's still happening, where it was this crazy thing. You could use your credit card. You walk into the pot store and you say, I'd like $100 of whatever. But you don't buy pot with it, you buy Bitcoin with it. And then the Bitcoin is immediately sold, right, to this other company. And it's a you know, lightning fast transaction. And I'm not sure if that ever became legal or if that's become widespread. I've sort of lost track of that.
I haven't heard about that here in Arizona, but then I haven't patronized. I'll ask my husband. Okay. Well, anyway, so we're in Colorado, and that was an interesting plot. And then I'm trying, was the fourth one Memphis?
The fourth one was Memphis,
and then Iceland.
And then Iceland.
Right. So, I mean, not only is he traveling, but he's actually out of the country. What was the inspiration? You just wanted to go to Iceland? You went there with your son.
I went
was
there with my
it?
Son. That was it exactly.
Okay.
He was, I think, 17, and he'd been lobbying. Or maybe he was 16. He'd been lobbying hard to go to Iceland. He's a photographer, and there's all this, you know, Iceland porn out there with these gorgeous, you know, mountains and waterfalls, and so we went on a 5-day backpacking trip. We were there 11 days, and we went across the Hornstrandir Peninsula, which is the far northwestern corner. That's a nature preserve, and it was just gorgeous and stunning. And my feet were wet for 5 days, and we were cold and hungry, and it was glorious. That'll tell you a lot about me, I guess. But in the airport on the way home, and then we did some driving, and there's a great bookstore that my son found, and he where you can buy books by the kilogram.
I love that.
So he brought home several kilos of books in Icelandic, by the way, which we do not speak. But in the airport, this idea for this book just sort of showed up, and I did not... I kind of scribbled it down, and I, you know, for I had about 20 minutes with this idea, like living in my head, and then it just disappeared. It's kind of what happened. So I had my notes, and it was like, okay, here's the book, and I'm going to sort of reconstruct it from my notes. And that was the book where I missed my deadline by 8 months.
Right.
Because it turns out that's not how I actually write books. I don't write from a plan. I sort of start at the beginning and write to the end. I make it up as I go along, and it was really difficult but I really love that book.
Well, you had some very interesting relationships. I mean, I've been to Iceland several times, and I have a, I'll tell you at dinner, a great story about my daughter, the photographer, who disappeared over a cliff in pursuit of a puffin. And I sat there thinking, how am I ever going to explain to her husband and my father
that my child
has gone into the Atlantic on my watch? You know, because that's your big fear when you're a mom, is your kid's going to drown in the bathtub while you're on the phone. You know, I mean, that's a fairly scary thing. And so here I thought, she's all grown up.
Oh my goodness.
And then she appeared back over the cliff and won contests for her puffin pictures.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, fabulous. Yes. But anyway. So now we come back to Milwaukee.
Right.
Right. So now you're like home.
Right. And that was kind of a COVID decision because it was hard to travel. And so I thought, well, I already live in Milwaukee, so I can write about Milwaukee again. And that was another technology book.
Right.
And so I was playing with Milwaukee. It used to be known as the machine shop to the world. That was Milwaukee's, one of Milwaukee's many names for a while.
I thought it was the beer shop of the world.
Well, it was, I don't know about the brewery part, but the Cream City, we're also known as because of our dairy there. But yeah, we had, I don't know, I think more breweries per capita in, in Milwaukee for many years. All the Germans.
I remember living near it, you know, and there's a lot of great things about Wisconsin. I mean, I'm really going to digress here, but you're not old enough to remember this, the Great Margarine War, because there was, margarine was white. And that was how the dairy industry lived with margarine, because it didn't look like butter. And along came a proposal, and it came with a little orange. You would buy the margarine, and it had a little packet of orange liquid, and you massaged it into the margarine so it turned yellow, looked like butter. I'm telling you, it was a war. I mean, Wisconsin's a very interesting state.
It
in
is
many
a very
respects.
Interesting state.
Currently, you have a judge that should be disbarred, but moving on from that. Right. Yeah. So from Milwaukee, now we're back in, where are we, in Nebraska when this book opens, or South Dakota?
Nebraska is,
we are
is
in Nebraska,
where
the corn
most of the action
state. No, it's Iowa. What do we call the, what's
Nebraska?
My father was born in Alliance, Nebraska. You'd think I could remember this.
You know, that's a factoid I do not have at my command.
Isn't Iowa the corn state? Don't I have that right? What's Nebraska?
Well, the Nebraska Cornhuskers is there. That's the football team.
Yeah, I know, but... Well, I can do this.
I don't know.
I will look it up while we talk about Nebraska. So,
that's right.
I mean, why did you pick Nebraska? Because it's sort of wide open, endless miles?
In part, yeah. My son had gone on a road trip with a couple of friends, and I had seen his pictures, and they sort of captured me. And I was reading about sort of farm country and the Midwest. The last book had been very urban, and so I wanted to do something that was, I'm usually reacting sort of, from the previous book. So I wanted to do something more rural, and I wanted to do something that was more intimate, that was a kind of a smaller story. Some of the previous books have had very, very big consequences. And I wanted to do something that was really kind of down to one person's soul, is kind of what this book comes down to. And so, you know, reading about farm country, and it's gorgeous. I don't know if anybody's driven through, you know, Nebraska.
It is the Cornhusker state.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful, and it's so open, and the sky is so huge. But it also, you feel like a little speck in a way that, like in farm country in Wisconsin, you know, we have a lot more topography and we have a lot more trees. And so you.
And barns. Serious barns.
And so in.
Lakes too. Yep.
But so the horizon is smaller there. Mm-hmm. I ended up writing about, really about sort of isolation and sort of hardship in a very kind of, you know, farm country, rural America way, where the jobs are dwindling, the cities, the towns are shrinking. In some places you drive an hour to go to the grocery store. That's sort of the feeling that I'm trying to capture, is where you both feel so small in comparison to the landscape, but you also feel sort of trapped and hemmed in because of your circumstances. So Helene, when we meet her, so there's another character in this book who has almost as much time on the page as Peter does. Mm-hmm. And when we meet her, she's working the night shift at a rural gas station. at the far western edge of the Great Plains. And there are only two people left in this town. There's her and there's her boss, who owns the gas station. He owns the trailer that she rents from him, and he's also a deputy sheriff. So he really feels like he kind of owns her. And he's getting increasingly obnoxious, and she really decides that she needs to get out of there. And at a certain point, a man comes in for gas in the middle of the night, and
he's driving a big rig.
He's driving a big truck. He's got double gas tanks. He can go a long, long way. And she realizes that this is her only opportunity to get away from her circumstances. And so she walks out to the pump and says, "Hey, mister, take me with you." And he says, "Well, where do you want to go?" And she says, "Anywhere but here." And so that's sort of that sense of being closed in and needing to escape. And that was kind of the start of the, I mean, it's the first section of the book. And that was the first thing that I wrote. And then, of course, the challenge is to find the next thing. It's the problem when you write by the seat of your pants, like I do.
Right. So I don't know how far we can carry this. Anyway, he's an attractive guy, and he's spending a fortune on fuel.
And he's nice to her.
Yep.
He's kind to her, which doesn't happen a lot in her world.
No. And compared to the guy she's trying to escape from.
Yeah.
Her mom has died. She's all alone. I mean, she has no family and no money and, you know, no real skill set. I mean, so she's truly in a dead end to a remarkable degree.
Right.
So anyway, off they drive. And then we can't really tell you what happens after that. But he's an interesting character, too. Did you see him as he is at the beginning, or did he evolve without talking about what he evolved into?
I didn't quite. I knew he was a bad, bad man.
Oh, come on. You already blew it.
But I didn't know why or how.
Yeah.
I just knew that Helene thought she was saving herself, and in fact she was getting into a worse condition.
It's the proverbial out of the frying pan moment, right?
Which is kind of my job, is to do that.
Well, no, that's true. But on the other hand, maybe a more conventional person, or a person that was traveling with family or in a car. Or something would not have taken her, you know. So I mean, that's always the gamble, is that a guy was actually willing to take this girl in that situation.
Right.
Maybe there was always going to be something suspect about him.
Right.
So when Peter meets her, she's enormously pregnant. I mean, ready to pop, so to speak.
I'm glad you said that, not me.
Why? Is it a female thing? I get to. I've been enormously pregnant.
I once said something like that to my wife, and she was not happy. Yeah.
Oh, well, maybe her experience was worse than mine. Whatever. Anyway, and there she is. So you don't know she's driving a car, isn't it? Not a truck.
Yeah,
Peter's driving a truck.
Peter's driving his 1968 Chevy pickup, and she's driving a car that stopped running.
Right. And they are in a kind of interesting, bottomland situation?
Yeah, they're by the Missouri River at a gravel road. And Peter is making his way back. He's just picked up his truck. He's making his way back to see June. But, a pregnant woman asks you for a lift. I mean, what are you supposed to do? It's not Peter's fault that he helped. That's all I'm saying. Because June gets a little irate when Peter gets into trouble, but it's not his fault. It's just how he's built. It's just how he's made. Yeah.
So would you have done that? Would you, if you've been driving your truck across the
wilds
of Nebraska?
Oh,
and a
sure.
Woman?
I have done equally stupid things.
I thought you were going to say chivalrous.
Well, chivalrous, yes.
Yeah.
Well,
some chivalrous things are actually stupid if you really think about them. So.
But so that's the thing about places that are not, they're very sparsely populated.
Yeah.
Is that it takes a long time for help to show up. And so you have to help your neighbors. You have to, I've run into this on backpacking, where you run into somebody who's in trouble, and it's like, okay, we're going to change our plan. We're going to divert ourselves, because who else is going to help?
Yeah.
So I think that's a it's no longer a commonplace thing. But I used to pull over to help people with breakdowns. Not that I know anything about how to fix cars, but You know, I'd give you a ride to the gas station or any of those things. So I'm a big believer in that.
Well, we're in a litigious society. I think that being Good Samaritans has become riskier than it used to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think most people are willing to help if, you know, there's something right at hand and no immediate help in sight. Even if it's to stop and use your phone to call for help. But of course, if you're in the Missouri bottomlands, you know.
Right, there's no signal.
There's, well, not only no signal, but probably no help.
Right, no help to be had, yeah.
Close enough to do. Anyhow, but you know, you've touched on one of the problems I think that thriller writers and all have to address, which is in a technological age, you know, what do you do? You have to come up with reasons to disable telephones and other stuff. Actually, I was having a conversation with Oliver Burke last week, and her book hinges upon a woman with amnesia who doesn't know, has not found, she was in an accident, a brain accident, and traumatized her, so you know she lost her memory, and nobody has ever been able to identify her. So it's like 10 years later, and now she's grown up. She was probably a teenager, and all, and you know you're pretty sure that at some point who she is going to come and confront her. But I mean, I said to Alfred, you know, the problem with that today is that you can hardly get away with that plot because one, fingerprints data, you know, two, DNA,
right.
Ancestry.com, you know, take a sample.
Or just
and three,
a facial search on Facebook.
Exactly,
I mean,
that's what I was going to say. Or three, increasing, you know, use of facial recognition. So the really handy mystery plot of the amnesiac victim who wakes up, you know, and nobody knows, they don't know who they are, nobody else knows who they are, and it all kind of goes from there. It's another plot, like the missing heir, being shot down by technology, you know, so you have to adapt. But you know, where you have Peter is excellent in the sense that you can reasonably say there is no cell phone coverage, so he's on his own.
Well, and Peter also tends to lose his phone a lot, conveniently for the author. But it is a problem. I've talked to any number of writers about this and how it has made it really hard to tell all kinds of stories, and how nice it would be to write a story set in the 70s, you know, back when there were payphones. And
well, I think people are. Alfair actually set this book, I think she said, in the 90s. I mean, it wasn't super contemporary because she already thought about, you know, can I credibly, you know, do this story in today? Yeah.
Well, the other problem, though, is when you're writing a series, is that there's a point at which, you know, you have to sort of say, well, I mean, if I were Peter, I would at a certain point figure out that maybe I should stop getting into, you know, these life-threatening troubles, right? Peter's a bright guy. You'd think that, you know, something would click, and but that's not what a crime series is, right? Peter has to keep making these bad decisions, or good decisions that turn out badly. And there's a point at which you know, as the author, you just sort of have to say, well, I guess Peter doesn't learn his lesson.
Well, come on. You know, we've talked about Reacher. Reacher is the guy walking down the street by the dry cleaner, and somebody stumbles out, and there he is. He doesn't give a thought to what you're. So I don't know. I don't know that you need to. I think the reader goes with it and expects this to happen.
But Reacher.
You don't want him to apologize for it.
No. But Reacher doesn't. That's one of the things that I think Lee does beautifully, and now Andrew is doing beautifully, is that Reacher doesn't evolve. Right, Reacher is a static character. Right, he doesn't change from book to book. He's still on the way to Omaha.
And single.
Right, and single.
Yep.
And I mean, there are a couple of books where there are some of those. He makes some of those motions, but they don't stick.
No, and there's a couple where it's passed in the army and so forth.
Right.
You know, or a family thing. There's at least one book I think with his father. And all, but you know, but basically, he's a man. There's no memory in the Reachers, which I think is a good way to describe it.
But it's really hard as a writer to do that. I think it's really hard to do that and have it feel so fresh and so original every time. Originally my thought was to sort of say, well, Peter's just gonna, you know, that he's not gonna change from book to book. But I just couldn't do it. In part, I just kind of wanted to see what was going to happen. And in part two, the sort of the fever pitch of that post-traumatic stress in the first book, I don't think was sustainable over the long haul either. So that's also part of Peter's journey, is that his he's a combat veteran. He's got post-traumatic stress that takes the form of claustrophobia, but he's working on it, right? He's trying to become a better person, as he says, and also to live a larger life, a more full life. I mean, that's kind of how Peter is evolving, but I think it's really hard to do that static character, especially now.
Yeah, but you don't want him to evolve to the point where he doesn't do any of the things make us want to read about it.
Because then he's like an accountant in Poughkeepsie, and that's not very interesting.
Right. Are you aging? You're not really aging him in real time, right? It's more like month to month?
You can't
age him in real time. It will all go south.
No, although there's a point at which, you know, Peter, as a somewhat recent veteran, like something has to sort of shift, like how Elvis Cole, the great Robert Crace character, at a certain point was no longer a Vietnam vet.
Spencer's a Korean War vet. Well, I know it. Talking about him on Saturday. You know, he's really 100 and whatever, right, and still working out at the gym.
Right.
You know, yeah. Readers go with it. You know, I think you really do have to move Peter very, very slowly through time, because if he is on a journey, you're going to get him to his destination too fast, and then we won't be able to carry on.
Well, or else I think you're right. I think you don't want too much evolution, because then that really becomes the primary story, mm-hmm, as well. And that's really the, you know, sort of the secondary thing is what's going on with Peter or Peter and June, as well. It's kind of how is their relationship evolving?
Yeah, well, I mean, what's so interesting about Peter is the fact that he steps in and helps people, you know? I mean, and you don't want to lose that, but I mean, if he settles down, you know, he has a job, and I mean, once you start getting self-protective, you know, then there's less of that possible. So, I mean, he's kind of like a knight errant, you know, wandering around in his trusty steed called the truck,
right?
You know, and even knight errants had girlfriends.
Sure. Well, and the goal again is to, you know, is to get to sort of explore. Part of what I enjoy is about sending them in different places is to really dig into what those places are,
right,
and to think about, you know, to sort of pick a place and to think about what are the stories that kind of place would engender. And so, like my version of Memphis, right, where I'm writing about a homeless musician kid, right? So that is my version of Memphis, right? That is not that's not John Grisham's Memphis. But it suggests a kind of plot and a kind of story, and that's the other fun thing is to dive into place in those ways.
So is that what you do? Do you decide on the place and then work on the story, or do you think of a story idea and then figure out a place that fits it? I know about Iceland because you were there, but
it's a little bit of both, and the place. Sort of start with a place and an idea, but then the idea often changes. So like the Memphis book was supposed to be, the Memphis is in the middle of what's called the New Madrid Fault Zone, which is this giant earthquake zone that has not fired since the 1800s.
Right, which was the worst earthquake ever experienced in the United States.
That's right, and the Washington Monument moved, you know, however many hundreds of miles away that was.
Mm-hmm.
But so I sort of thought that was going to be kind of a man against nature book, sort of a disaster book. And Peter would go there and would have to, you know, go help people who were in trouble and blah, blah, blah. But the earthquake never showed up because I fell in love with this street musician I started writing about. And then suddenly sort of it was about Peter and the kid and a friend of June's who Peter had gone to help. So I start out intending to do one thing and I end up doing something else entirely.
Where it took you, so to speak. Yeah. So you got to Nebraska, you're driving around,
mm-hmm,
soggy land and the whole bit. Did mm-hmm. you just see a vision of this woman coming towards you?
No, so I wrote the Helene piece, that first couple
you
of
wrote
chapters.
That first?
And then I thought, I mean, I really liked her. I mean, the reason why she has such a large role in the book is she just sort of kept showing up again. She's I don't know. She's kind of something special for me, but I sort of thought I can't. How does this become a Peter Ash book? Like I couldn't see how this was gonna work. Like she just seemed too big. So then I wrote another beginning of a different book, okay. But it wasn't as good. And then I wrote a third beginning and it was still worse. And I just...
I'm glad you didn't get discouraged.
No, well, no, it's kind of the story of my life. And so I just thought, well, maybe I should go to Nebraska. So I threw my crap in the minivan and I drove. And that was the thing that sort of clarified that this really was a book about Helene. And here is how she's going to connect to Peter. And this is sort of what the whole feeling of the story is going to be like when you're in that landscape.
Mm-hmm.
It really shifts. For me, it shifts how I think about things. It's not like I'm taking notes and interviewing people, and I'm just sort of wandering around talking to myself. It's a very sophisticated research process.
Well, at least you went there.
I did.
Yeah, yeah. A certain feeling of authenticity.
Yes.
So now that you're back in middle America, do you already have a concept for where he's going next?
I'm trying to decide.
You don't want to talk about it.
Well, I'm not far enough to really have a clue. I'm trying to decide, and...
How about the hostile desert landscape that surrounds Scottsdale, Arizona?
That would be fun. Well, I think I have to do another city book, so it could be.
Why?
Because the last one was so rural.
So?
I don't know. It's just kind of what's calling my name.
You don't want a TikTok like
that.
No,
that's true.
Come on.
That's true. I don't know. It's. I know it's a Lewis book.
Oh, okay.
So Lewis is Peter's best friend. He's a career criminal who's sort of gone straight, sort of not really.
And really useful.
Yes, yes. Lewis is an excellent dude.
Nailed the model.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, so Lewis is often helping Peter, and so Lewis steps into Peter's world. And so this is the book where Peter helps Lewis, and we step into Lewis's world.
Okay.
So the question is, I know that it begins in Milwaukee, and I don't, I have a couple of options for where it's going to go next, but I really don't quite.
You're not there yet.
I'm banging my head against it currently.
Okay. I like the idea of it being a Lewis book. I like Lewis a lot. Yeah, that would be great. Because June had a pretty large role in the last book, if I remember.
She did. She did. She had, there's about 20% June from her point of view in the last one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's the other thing that's really fun about this series is to dive into other characters and to really, I don't think I'll do something where another character has 50% of the pages like with this book, or maybe not quite yet, but it was really fun to do something that dove into somebody else in that kind of way.
Okay. So, given your fairly eclectic work history before you started writing, didn't I put that nicely? Yes. Have you thought about, you know, writing something other than Peter, or, you know, just as a little break? Or is Peter still so fascinating you haven't been driven to think about another character?
Well, I proposed a different, a standalone book to my publisher, and they said, well, I'm sure this would be wonderful, but we really want more Peter.
Especially after the New York Times review.
Well, this was before the New York Times review, but they read this book, and my editor and my agent both kind of were over the moon and said, no, we need to really do some more Peter. So I'm in part the Lewis book is sort of some of the ideas from the standalone book, which is really about sort of a more criminal sort of emotional landscape.
Okay.
Which is Lewis's past. So I don't know. It's I'm having fun. I'm just still at a stage where it's not that I haven't found my footing yet. I don't know. Maybe I haven't found my footing yet. Beginning a book is a weird process, especially when you don't start with an outline, which I wish I could work that way.
Well, everybody works differently, you know. Mm-hmm. We've had this discussion over
many
32
times.
Years,
many
you know.
Times,
every writer
yeah.
has his or her own truth and, you know, system that works, and it's not transferable.
No, it's not. Although it's one of the fun things to talk with other writers about is kind of how do you work and what works for you. And sometimes it's, you know, nuts and bolts stuff. Like Greg Hurwitz has these two monitors that he uses. So he's got notes on one and he's got the book on the other and he's going back and forth. And, you know, that never occurred to me to do something like that. Mark Graney is, he wants to, his goal to be at his laptop within 15 minutes of getting out of bed, 5 minutes if he can do it. So it's like,
on the way.
Well, I'm sure there's a coffee maker out in the, along the way, but I just think that's a really interesting, it's really interesting to me how other people work. And I've learned a lot from other writers along the way about, and it's informed how I work. So it's
and
one
how
of the,
do you work?
I am a morning person. I'm not a morning person, but I'm a morning writer.
Okay.
I'm at the computer within an hour of getting up. I don't check my email. I don't listen to a podcast. I try not to have a very complicated conversation with my wife.
Is that possible? Some days.
I married an extrovert, which is for a writer sometimes slightly challenging. And she would argue that marrying a writer was challenging.
But you weren't a writer when you got married.
I was, actually.
Were you?
I was not a published writer. But,
oh, okay.
I drink some coffee, I eat some oatmeal, and I work until the coffee expires, and then I eat a little lunch, and I go for a walk, and then I go back to work. Then I treat it like a 9-to-5. That's kind of the what gets me to keep my butt in the seat. And I tend to work 6 days a week, sometimes seven, depending on how close the deadline is, as well. And I go back and forth. Sometimes I'm working on with two monitors, and sometimes it's one. But I have a big artist notepad that I use for drawing diagrams and sort of figuring out plot ideas. With no lines, you can draw arrows and sort of scribble around the margins, and it looks like it's sort of a mad scientist's diagram.
Or a kindergartner's. Absolutely. So once you develop the voices, for Peter and then Lewis and then June, that's a solid base that you've got to work with, and then you just have to work on new characters and new voices, but at least you have some stability.
Well, and it's interesting. Writing a series is I've had this conversation with other writers too, where they sort of say, "Oh, writing a series, you already know who your characters are. You already know the kinds of stories you're telling," and that's true. That there is that you have a place to start, but you also sort of say, "Well, I've done this idea," and the more books I've written, the more it's like, so, okay, I've done that. And so it's harder to, you can't sort of lean on your reflexes anymore.
Okay.
You have to sort of develop things in a different way, almost out of a whole cloth, as opposed to sort of saying, well, let's see, I've always been interested in X, Y, or Z. Whereas, I think, for people who write series, we sort of think, oh, a standalone, that's how freeing. And they're like, are you kidding? You have to invent the whole universe with every book. So it's an interesting process.
Some people really like world building, and other people, do not. I think The Runaway is a terrific book, and it's interesting that in a long series, somewhere oftentimes around book seven, there's like a lift. I don't know exactly how to explain it, but series tend to either progress or die somewhere right around this book. They either, it's like, streaming television, whatever it is, it goes through
whatever
five or
the
six
season
seasons,
is,
and then there you are. And I definitely sense a lift.
Well, thank you. I appreciate
in The Runaway.
That. I appreciate that.
I did. I really enjoyed it. It was different. It was surprising. It's very pacey. It's just a really neat book. I hope you all are going to enjoy it as much as I did. How about questions from any of you? You're all stunned by our eloquence about that, guys.
Oh.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Well, you talked about how the characters, you've tried different things with them already. Does that put you in the straitjacket a little bit in terms of what their attitude would be to a certain situation as they've exhibited already? Do you have to keep track of all that? You know what I'm saying?
No, that's a great question. The question is really, because I know who the characters are, do they have to behave in a certain way? No, because they're all evolving, right? So, and their relationships to each other are evolving. And the funny thing is that, this series has a really big female readership, and I think it's because of the characters. It's because people really care about who these folks are and how they interact with each other. And real people are not static, right? I mean, if you have a cardboard cutout character who is all rugged good looks and chiseled abs, you know, they are who they are because they're already, you know, there's not a lot of there. But as characters get more complicated, and that's one of the nice things about writing a series, is you can really continue to develop the characters as you go. And then, so there, people aren't consistent. Not everybody, I mean, I'm not terribly consistent. And relationships evolve and people have disagreements or, you know, things change. And that's part of the fun with every book. And that's one of the early questions I ask myself. So, like, where are Peter and June? You know, what is their relationship like at the beginning of this book? And if I know, I need to know that, and I need to know kind of, you know, is Peter kind of in an up or down phase, right? Is he feeling better, or is he feeling, you know, is the post-traumatic stress sort of coming back? Is it getting worse? And those are the things that sort of help me figure out, you know, kind of the tone and the feeling of the book. I don't feel trapped by the characters at all. And also you get to throw in new characters, right? So, you know, the they're all bouncing off each other. And so it gets nice and chewy in there. It's a very technical writer term, I think, but yeah.
Chewy. I like
chewy,
that.
Yeah.
Excellent
yeah.
verb for writing. Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, do you ever delve into his childhood or anything to see how he evolved into going into the military or anything?
I have an idea for Peter at like 15 or 16. Mm-hmm. And we know a little bit about Peter's parents. Mm-hmm. His parents actually took in, Peter grew up in northern Wisconsin, outside of a town called Bayfield, which is a sort of summer tourist destination, you know, kind of surrounded by farms and national forest. And Peter's parents, his dad was a carpenter. He and his dad and his uncle have a home building business together. And so his parents took in troubled kids, strays. So if you find yourself 15 and pregnant and kicked out of the house by your parents, you go to the Ash House. So that's part of where Peter has gotten his sort of sense of stepping in and doing the right thing. Is from his how he grew up, but I would like to see what Peter is like at that age, and to see that formation a little bit. So
you have two choices: you can write a prequel, or you can write a book in which his past history has to be revealed
right.
as part of the narrative.
Right.
And you know, my experience is with almost any long-running series, the author is always driven to writing a prequel of some kind, because you just picked an arbitrary time to meet this character, and then when you get to know him, it just develops that way.
Right.
You know,
right.
that you want to go back earlier.
Right.
So, you know, you've got different ways that you can do it. Did you have a question over there, sir? Did I see? No? No hand raising? No? Everybody through with questions? Wonderful. Well, in that case, let me thank you very much for coming. Let's give our author a round of applause.
Okay.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.